Marian Alcoholic, grateful to be here and just absolutely loving being in California. California, yay. You know, it's just awesome to be here with my husband, Peter, who you're going to have later on tonight, our friends Chip and Angie, and others that are going to be around here. Our hosts last night who picked us up at the airport, Terry and Sergio. We thought the car was going to get towed. I don't know. But we had an hour. We had to get it under an hour, but we made it, and we got there, and it worked out great. So grateful to be here, grateful to be sober, great to be a member of Good Standing and Alcoholics Anonymous, and an interpreter. I love that. Yes. Oh, that's just wonderful. Oh, my gosh. I won't use too many really big words, I promise. That's not how I roll. My sobriety date is November 11th, 1989. Yes, thank you. I know you look at me, she looks like she's 40 and she's 36 years sober. I know. How can it be? I know I get that all the time. No, just teasing. Sober date, November 11th, 1989. Home group is No Problems, Just Solutions in Boca Raton, Florida. And we meet on Wednesday nights and we go through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you've ever heard of that. And I'm sure you have, just teasing. We go through the Big Book. We have two speakers Wednesday nights, go from the first 164 pages, and it changes every month, two speakers, but it is alive and it is rocking. And, you know, we have this fellowship before the meeting, we have this friend who makes the coffee, and he likes to flicker the lights like last call at the end of the night. Okay, you guys got to get out of here. I got to lock the door. But that's the fellowship I crave, you know, where it used to be, you know, lights out and I'm finally leaving. Now it's that way in our parking lot of the church that we visit. And whoa. And to me, there's nothing like a good church basement and a rotten cup of coffee. You know, it's like, I remember my first home group, I was like, always going to the business meeting, we need Starbucks. And it's like, oh, come on. You know, and that's just the deal, you know, it's that the fellowship we crave, the, you know, my first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous was I washed ashtrays. And it made me feel a part of something for the first time in my entire life. There was God and there was fellowship in that sink, you know. And it was beautiful to be a part of from the first day of Alcoholics Anonymous when my hand went on the door. But that's not how it started. I'm going to breathe. Born and raised in Bellingham, Washington. Yes, look at that. I love it. Just a little north of Seattle and south of Vancouver, BC, back in the 70s. Yeah, I love that. Back in the 70s, we were in the Guinness Book of Records for the most hippies per capita. Yes. I am a flower child. Can't say, represent, right? But, man, this is how we rolled with Birkenstocks and socks. And I was thinking about when he was reading more about alcoholism, when it goes into that part of, you know, we can increase the list ad infinitum. It's like ad infinitum, you know. I mean, if that was made today, like Woody, you know, on Toy Story would be saying infinite, or the space guy, infinity and beyond. Like, how could our stories, all the methods we try to get through and drink like a normal person, you know, it's just crazy. And to me, because I'm a hippie child, it was like, what a long, strange trip it'd been. You know, it was a trip. It was. The methods I tried in the 70s, or when my kids were in middle school, I'm just going as it's coming, guys. In middle school, I had this $700 Volkswagen bus with these purple curtains I made, and it had bells that were hanging down for curtains. And I take my kid, you know, I'm stone cold sober, and you know, when they're in middle school, because I got sober when they were little, but they were so embarrassed by that Volkswagen bus. And they're like, "Mom, can you drop us off a block away from the school, please?" You know, and so I do it. Okay, I understand. But one day there was a field trip. There was a field trip, and all the kids in their class was like, "Okay, we're gonna ride the bus." And then everybody thought the bus was cool, and so then I became a cool mom, you know. But so that was early sobriety, and that was a beautiful thing, and being able to show up for them as a show up as a mother that was sober and present and be able to be there for them. So, Bellingham, Washington, born and raised in an alcoholic home. We understand it later on. It was normal in my life. My father was a World War II veteran named Dude. He was the original Dude back in the 40s in the Army. And my mom was born and raised in the Aleutian Islands up in Alaska. And my dad came in on a tugboat and swept her away and brought her down to Bellingham. And, you know, so I had that strong tie to Alaska growing up, a strong tie to veterans. My dad, you know, I have a sponsor. Her name is Polly P. And when you meet Polly, the first thing she asks us as sponsees is, you guys, I cry and laugh at the same time. It's ridiculous. You know, all the stories, being 36 years sober and the power of the 12 steps and the power of great sponsorship, even some Al-Anon with my girl Angie, you know, all that stuff. It's like I used to feel like, how did I get raised like this? And so much shame and so much, you know, God, just hated who I was and all this stuff. And when Polly first meets us, she says, tell me about your mom and dad. You know, and my dad was, his dad died when he was 8 years old. My mom was raised up in Alaska with alcoholism and poverty. And, you know, my dad's mom had 8 kids to raise, and they had it rough. And here's the deal, guys, is we can grow up in this way. I mean, and some of us, I mean, Park Avenue to Park Bench, I always say, you know, I wish I, you know, drank too many martinis in Beverly Hills, but that's not my story, you know? But raised in this family, there were 6 kids, okay? So 3 boys and 3 girls. And I'm raised in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and there used to be the show, I don't know if you know it, called The Brady Bunch. And we used to watch that show. And we were like, man, we want Sam the Butcher. You know, we want Alice the Maid. You know, we really want that life. But that wasn't how it was for us. And we pretend like we were them, though. So I'm the middle girl in the family. And so that means I was Jan. And I always wanted to be Marcia, you know? But it was really like a theme for my life, as I just wanted to be anybody else than the little Weston kid in the middle of the block, you know, going to other girls' houses with the bikes and the Barbies and the bows in their hair and the ruffles on the socks. I never had one of those pairs of socks. I might have to buy one of those for me. My husband felt bad for me one day because he hears my story over and over again. And he came in our house one day and he peeks in the door and in his hand, he had a bag of Barbies for me. It was just like, darling, you know? That's my boy. Yeah. And it's never too late to have a happy childhood. And it was, though, at the exact same time, alcoholism with mom and dad, but the alcoholism that ran rampant and with my brothers and sisters and all this stuff. And we ran the streets and we ran wild, you know, riding in the back of the pickup truck and drinking out of a hose and sliding down dirt cod hill on a piece of cardboard. Man, that was life. And it was, you know, and like, but all of that, like underneath of all of that, the kids would still our house crazy, but the kids would always want to be there. And my mom would always look at it like, that's just one more potato in the pot, you know, one more kid to feed, what's one more mouth to feed? And that's what our home was like. You know, the fights would break out and the whiskey bottle would hit the wall, and, you know, that's just the way it is, you know. So I better get to drinking here in a minute. So I'm 15 years old. My middle school years were really good. My grades were good. I'm the middle kid, and I don't want to cause trouble, and I want to be, you know, I want to fix stuff at home. When mom and dad would have a fight, I would be the one sent downstairs to break up the fight. Because I could sing, because I'm a singer, I could sing and dance with dad and, you know, break up the fight. And so what use is there for any God? Why do I need a God? I know how to play God at that age. But I'm the good kid, and I'm not getting in trouble. I'm a gymnast, and I'm a singer, and, you know, I've got good grades, and all this stuff is happening for me till I hit high school. I'm too scared to join the choir. The gymnastics coach and I never got along, And I ran for class secretary, and I lost. And it's like this year at 15 was tough. It was tough, like all these things that were just really keeping me connected to community and to school and purpose were like slipping away from me. So I found my new best friend, and that was a bottle of MD 2020. That I ripped off from the liquor store or the grocery store. I had it inside my jacket. I go to a high school dance, and it was a real social drink. I went into the stall, shut the door, and I took a big pull off that thing. And immediately it went in the toilet, you know? But the second drink went down, and we always talk about this like it's a panacea for our ills. You know, I was on my way, and I needed that booze. You know what I mean? I became someone else. I'm the party girl in high school. I don't have a car, but I sure as heck have borrowed your car. And I have sure as heck have that keg in the back seat. Katie gets it. She knows. She's that girl. Of course she does, because we already get that. Yeah. And so high school years are cool, you know. I'm just, well, cool, not cool. You know, missing school and other things, you know, things that you roll up with white papers happening. And I'm a hippie, okay? This is what's happening. But I find this new identity. And there's already, like, consequences in high school for my drinking. But you know what I mean? I don't know it's about the drinking. You know, I don't know that. So fast forward, I'm 18 years old. I go to this party, and, you know, the break up the fight thing with the mom and dad. There's these two guys at this party. They're getting in a fight, and this one guy didn't have a shirt on, and they're fighting, and I look across the room, and it was love at first sight. My sidekick. This is so cool to have him by my side, because he's always by my side and holding me up. All the time. But the thing is that, you know, our friend Bob says, you know, we live life forward, we understand it backwards. And what I found in this man was a way to get out of the house, number one. And number two, I got another man to fix besides my dad. And this is who it's going to be. And so I get pregnant. My dad's fishing in Alaska. And We have a shotgun wedding thing, and dad's not really happy. Dad never liked him. Dad was right. It's okay. He's the father of my children and grandchildren. That's okay. But so I end up pregnant, and I'm 19 years old, and I have my first child on Christmas Day, 1979. That's Brandon. The following year, in March, or 13 months later, I have my son Jacob. And the next year, in 5 months, I have my third, and it's my daughter, Jessica. And here's the deal, guys. I'm the alcoholic housewife in every way, whatever kind of housewife I am. I'm busy trying to give my kids everything I didn't have. We moved into my mom and dad's old house, and we built a sandbox and a treehouse, and, you know, giving them the things I never had. But on the inside, I know that I was neglecting them. Emotionally and physically, I was neglecting them. Here's the deal. We can say this in one sentence today as alcoholic moms, is that I loved and cherished those kids, but I also neglected them. I did. And the deal was this. It was like three kids like that close. It's like diapers and bottles and bottles for me, and diapers and bottles and bottles and diapers and bottles and bottles. And that's how I'm getting through everything. But that's the, you know, our big book says this. It's it's our normal life. It's all we understand. This is what I'm doing. This is how I'm raised. Isn't this what other people do? And, you know, so the kids get a little bit bigger. They're 4, 5, and 6 years old. And I get pregnant for the fourth time. It's 1986. And it's like, okay, cool, I'm going to have another baby. And since the other three were close together, the thought was, okay, we're going to have this baby and we can all enjoy it together. And it's, you know, well, it's going to be set apart and it's going to be cool. So on October 19th, 1986, I give birth to my fourth child. And that was my son, Brian Daniel. And I had taken a little job at a grocery store so we could have insurance for the family. And when he was 3 months old, I went back to work at the little grocery store. And my little sister was babysitting him that day. And it was January 22nd, 1987. And my little sister goes into the bedroom to pick him up. He was taking a nap. She went into the bedroom to get him and came running out with him, and he was purple. And my son died of crib death that day, sudden infant death syndrome. And I'm 27 years old, and I've got three other little kids to raise, and I'm an alcoholic, and you don't have a handbook for that. My little sister, as soon as we grabbed him, the hospital was a couple blocks away, and we got up there and we just walked into the ER, and the nurse just took him in her arms and she said, "He's died." And, you know, later that same year, it's August, and my mom died of lung cancer and emphysema. And these aren't the things that make me an alcoholic. They're the things that helped my drinking progress even more. And I'm telling you, when I tell that story, I feel it. You know what I mean? How dark it is before the dawn, how absolutely dark and dreadful my life was. Because I have these three little kids. I'm not even thinking of their pain. Like, I don't even know how you deal with that as a little kid. And all I'm doing is I'm drinking, and I'm an alcoholic. What I'm thinking is that I've just lost my mind and I've gone crazy. And so finally what I did is I was like, I'm going to go see a therapist. I'm going to go see a shrink. I'm going to go see what is wrong with me. And in the beginning of Bill's story on the first page, he talks about the ominous warning. And I believe as alcoholics, when we get into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if you're like me. I had a lot of warnings before I came into the rooms. A lot of things going, maybe you shouldn't, maybe you shouldn't, you know, things like that. But what she said to me that day, and I'll remember this the rest of my life, was because they were full of these things, right? Full of these ominous warnings. And this woman sat across the desk from me and she said, "Marian, when you lose a child, you lose your future. And when you lose a parent, you lose your past. And you're having trouble living in today." And I was. And I was. I couldn't. So my life was so dark. And my previous husband before my husband, Peter, it got darker and darker and darker and never chose the path of recovery, never chose the path that chose, whatever. Granted, given, you know, whatever this is, a gift. And it just got darker and darker and darker for him. And so my story has a little thing like this, where I started sending those three little kids on Sunday mornings to a little Baptist church. And they had one of these short little buses. And they said, we're going to pick them up on Sunday morning, if you're okay with that. We'll pick them up at 9 a.m. and we'll bring them home at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I don't know, if you're an alcoholic housewife, that's pretty good free babysitting. So I sent them on their way, and I had an old timer tell me once, God took care of your kids when you couldn't take care of them. And he did. And God gave them comfort. So it was coming on October of 1988, and they're going to go do a trunk or treat at this old Baptist church. And they said, Mom, we're going to sing. Do you want to come? And I said, yeah. I don't know why I did. Inspired, whatever, that voice, that thing. And I showed up. The next day, that minister and his wife came over, and she took the kids upstairs, and she's talking to the kids, and I'm sitting there with this man, and that was October 18th, 1988. Not my day of sobriety, but my day of becoming. Found the God of my understanding. But you guys, the alcoholic torture just progressed. What it was is, like we say in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nothing worse than a belly full of booze and a head full of AA. And that's true. But it's also true that when your heart has been received by your Creator and you have this heart with God in it and you still can't get sober, waking up with those hideous four horsemen every morning and going on and completely obsessed with, why can I not quit drinking? And I know it's bad now. And I'd run to this preacher with this, why can't I get sober? I got God now. Why can't I get sober? Why can't I get sober? And then he would just be, you just keep praying, you just keep praying, and you just keep praying. That's October 18th, 1988, that happened. My permanent day of sobriety as of to this date, November 11th, 1989, another year of torture. As Bill's story and his disease progresses, mine progressed. So what happened is, this little hippy-dippy girl, woman that I am, I had this bad 80s perm. And it was badly matted because I hadn't picked it out or combed it. And the color was Clairol Champagne Blonde. And it was that color because of the name of the box, Clara, all right? So just to give you a picture of what I looked like, right? It's my 30th birthday. My 30th birthday, November 10, 1989. And a pretty swanky joint I went to in the morning to have my morning drinks to celebrate my birthday. I went to Denny's. And I drank till I got home and passed out. And I went out again that same night in this leopard print shirt that I'm not one to wear leopard. If you wear it, you wear it. I don't, because it reminds me of my last drunk with my matted hair and the whole deal. And I drank that night twice in one day till November 11th, 1989, which is my sobriety date. And what had happened is, I went downstairs to my bright pink bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I saw something I'd never seen before. Our book describes it as, I was at the jumping off place. That moment of grace, and every one of us have had it in this room. What was it? What was our life like the day before? The day before our permanent day of sobriety. Guys, think about it. Think about it. What happened between when I laid my head on the pillow, November 10th, 1989, to November 11th, 1989? The only place I've seen where it's this, you know, this phenomena, this thing is ideas, attitudes, and emotions, which were once the guiding force of my life, are suddenly cast aside for a whole new. It was, that was my day. It was my day. And you know, here's the deal. In that family of six kids, my little sister had gotten sober about 9 months before that. My next door neighbor had gone to a treatment center, the St. Joe's Hospital. He was had busy putting stuff up his nose, if you know what I'm talking about. And he had about 6 months. And when I looked in that mirror, and I saw myself for the first time, the thought came to me. In the back of our book, in the Southern Friend, he talks about the voice of God being a thought with a voice. See, we have it, guys. Call that sponsee back. Put your grocery cart back. You know, things like that. Help that lady across the street, being present and knowing. And in that moment of looking in the mirror, I had the thought, I need to go to treatment. Not that that's the answer, but I needed to get away from, I needed help. I needed the help. I did. And that thought came to me, and it wasn't received by my ex-husband. Well, he was like, go ahead, go, there's beer in the fridge, here another one of your ideas, you know. Because remember, I was the girl who was obsessed in trying to control and enjoy my drinking, list ad infinitum, or infinity and beyond, or whatever, right? And I was, and the reality was, I told this story in my hometown. I was doing a women's conference there. My big sister was sitting there, and she passed away in September, but she was sitting in the front row, and I was telling my story, and I said, yeah, and my big sister just showed up to take me to treatment. And she's like, Marion, you called me. Which I didn't remember. So in true Grateful Dead style, with my matted hair and my boxer shorts and a hoodie and Birkenstocks and socks, I took off to treatment. I was diagnosed a late second stage chronic alcoholic that day in that treatment center. I'd like to say that that first part was easy. I was in detox for 3 days. And what had happened to me is this. I'm laying there, and 3 days in treatment, I'm okay now. I was sure that I'd overreacted. I got to go take care of those kids. Thank you so much. You guys were great. Thank you. Think I got what I need now. And two alcoholics came in the room, but they weren't. I didn't know that they were alcoholics. What they were was Nurse Becky, who came in, who wasn't telling me, you know, what medications I should be on, and a therapist named Steven. He's gone to the big meeting in the sky, and 6'10". He didn't come in and tell me about, you know, my inner child or anything like that. But what they were was two alcoholics that sat at the end of the bed. You guys, the power of our stories, man. The power in our brokenness. The power in not talking down to somebody. My friend Ralph said this the other night in a meeting. Don't break the broken. Don't break the broken. I was so broken, but they understood me from this place of their own stories, and I could hear that. I heard it for the very first time. My husband calls it the music of AA. Some people do that, you know, and it's true. I heard it, and what I believe happened in that moment, in that day, in that detox, was this power of love of this God that I had in my heart that needed to be ignited was ignited by two members of Alcoholics Anonymous in a detox. As I laid in the bed, just like that story, the man in the bed, the picture that I love so much. And I've been here ever since, guys. I worked the first 3 steps in treatment center, Hanley style, whatever it was, in treatment. And man, oh man, I was sober. Ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing. And I'm in Western Washington, and where I lived my whole life. And we'd walk across the street to Cornwall Park, and we'd swing on the swings. And we'd be walking down these trails, and like the leaves were like red and orange and green and brown. And I'm like, God, do you guys see this? Do you see it? Isn't it beautiful? But it's true. It's like the veil's torn. I could see it. I remember one time when my kids were really little, we were going up the North Cascades Highway. And I'm like 6 months sober, and I'm driving up along the North Cascades Highway, and it's beautiful, and there's rivers, and there's canyons, and there's all the snow, and the valleys, and the rivers. And I literally found out, I experienced breathtaking for the first time in my life, like, wow, I'm alive for the first time, you know? And so I'm brought to my very first outside meeting. I had worked those three steps, and, you know, it was at dry dock, and they had the floors like this, and a radiator clanking, and the trains going by, and billows of cigarette smoke in the air, and, you know, and I'm like, great, this is what I'm going to be doing with my Friday night now. And one more time, this disease was trying to take me out in the early days. It was trying to get me to hook us. Guys, it's never done with us. It's the boy, it says, our book says, it's like the boy that's whistling in the dark. You know, I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. What am I doing with that? What does that look like? It doesn't end at 36 like, hey, I'm comfortable now. I can rest on my laurels and loll on the beach in the Florida sunshine and Destin with Chip and Angie, although that's a cool thing to do. But we're going to pretty much be talking about recovery, either side of that. You know? No. So I go to dry dock. It's Friday night. Oh, my God, my head is where this centers, man. It's going great. I'm a loser. Now I'm at this Friday night meeting, and there was an first American woman that was sitting on the bench. I don't know if I ever saw her again. And I know we see angels here. We feel angels, you know, people that are put in our lives at the right moment, at the right time, in the right second. And that woman was put there for me on Friday night at dry dock. And I don't know what she said. I just know that she was me. She was me. And it hit, you know what this language of the heart that we say, guys? I don't know, like the last couple weeks, this has just been profoundly with me, like really carrying it with me, like the absolute miraculous thing that happens when we come to a place where really, really, really we're powerless. We're deemed powerless. How incredible that is, guys. We cease fighting everything and everything. I'm powerless over, I'm sitting in treatment. What do you mean I don't have any power? I don't? No, I don't have power. There's freedom in that. The freedom in that, right? Lack of power is my dilemma. I'm with power, no dilemma. I can move forward in these steps and move forward in my life. So I get to my first home group. It's the Northwest Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My little sister was already there, hardly knew it. You know, my little brother followed in after me, and our big sister followed in after him, and you know, and we had a family that was sober and at the Northwest Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got that first commitment from a man named C.B. C.B. McLaren, I can give you his whole name because he's running the big meeting in the sky up there with a bunch of the other ones, you know. He had this alcoholic warty nose and a flat top and suspenders and a flannel shirt, and he's the very first person in Alcoholics Anonymous that extended his hand to me. Hi, Marion, welcome. Got my first sponsor, went to the campouts, went to the meetings, cleaned the ashtrays, and I was a part of the Northwest Group of Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of AA angel bikers and a lot of first Americans and all of us, we were a people that wouldn't normally mix it. Man, we had a good life. We had a good, and our deal was, man, our deal was the newcomer, taking them through the steps. You're really serious at Northwest about your recovery. This was how I would, you know, like if you went to the Wednesday night big book study and you went to the Monday night 12 and 12, you were really on fire. And that's how my sobriety was, but I needed a place to open share and I needed a place to be. So as my sobriety progressed and, you know, that first marriage, he was one of us who never found the solution. And it got harder and harder and harder and harder. And God released me from that marriage in 2004. And I got a divorce and I got a band. I mean, it's just like a country song. I had a country band and, you know, and wrote a bunch of songs about it, right? Kind of like Taylor does. Only mine made me a couple bucks, you know, but that's okay. It was really fun, you know. And the deal was this, like, you know, those kids became having their own kids, and I had my first grandchild when I was 44 years old. I had my little band. I worked in radio. That gave me all these little backstage passes. That was kind of fun. And, you know, and life was good, and I'm sober. I became the speaker coordinator at my home group, and it was, this is a fast forward to 2010. And guys, you know, we're going to bring in a speaker, a guest speaker, because this one guy was like talking to this guy in New Jersey, and it's 6 years after my divorce, and I just haven't, I'm feeling bad for me. I'm feeling bad. And I'm riding on a bike ride for the Cancer Society in October of 2010. And crying to my sister, I want to be married like you and Dave, and I want to know what that's like. And so my home group has this committee. We're going to have a meeting, and we're going to bring this man in from New Jersey, and we're going to have a potluck first, and then we'll bring him in. And I rode my bike in the morning, and I had this stupid AA commitment because I wasn't going to go because I had a show that night with my little band. And so, but in the afternoon, I had a commitment to bring a half a case of Diet Coke to this thing. And I was like, I guess I better go see who the speaker is. Right there. So, yes, yes, yes. Boy meets girl on AA campus. You know, but the deal was that we were poor. We were a clubhouse. We're a Northwest group. You know, we didn't have the money to bring him in. But Denial Dave had air miles. He raised his hand. And he had air miles, so we were able to fly him in and put him in a little hotel and put him up for the night. But we've been walking this walk together since 2010, 2011. It was like a year of talking long distance. Like, how do you do that? He's originally from Brooklyn. He's living in Jersey. He moves to Florida. I'm in Bellingham, Washington. I'm basically becoming a starving musician who's roofing for my brother, driving a dump truck so I can go back and forth to Florida. But guys, this is the way God is, right? It's like these being here on a slender thread. Being here with inches and seconds and the way that we get to meet and connect. Man, Katie and I, we were on the phone 1,000 times, and I already fell in love with her before I even met her. It was just, like, incredible. She makes me feel like kind of a tall Amazon woman or being around her. And I'm 5'2", so that's a stretch. It's fine. I know I got you by five. Yeah. So Peter and I get to walk this thing shoulder to shoulder, and those kids know, and those grandkids. I got 9 of them. I know. I said I was 42 at the beginning of this, remember? You know, so life is good, and we walk this shoulder to shoulder, and we get to travel together, and we have a host of friends, and just this absolutely beautiful life together in Destin and beyond, you know, and And so I'm grateful, grateful for a home group, grateful for our house that is buzzing with Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it's Peter with his sponsees on the phone or me with my sponsees on the phone. But it hasn't been, you know, man, these certain trials and low spots. Our book talks about certain trials and low spots. You know, September, we had walked my big sister through cancer, and she made it through all that. And I did it from 3,000 miles away because of the power of Facebook and FaceTime and all that stuff, you know. And the end of September, she passed away from swimming in Baker Lake, doing her favorite thing with her children and her grandchildren. She had a heart attack in the water. My niece described it as her heart just exploded. You know, the certain trials and low spot. Peter's father 3 years ago, who was his best friend, who kept telling me, because I'm Swedish, I'm Norwegian, I'm Aleut, I got all that stuff. I'm kind of a mutt, right? But I get together with Peter, they're full-blooded Italian, and he's like always, I'm going to make an Italian out of you yet, you know? And he was like this. This is really how it felt. I'm doing it. It felt like this. Welcome to the family. Yeah. And it was. His brother John were sitting at the Sunday table, and there's this pot in the middle of the table. And he looks at me dead in the eye, and he opens it up. Marion, this is Sunday gravy. Like he's giving me the code to, I don't know why, you know. So just getting two brothers, and my husband is a stepdad. Get it? Stepdad. And a step-grandpa, and we get to walk this together, and yeah, life is good. I'm going to read something. I think I'm getting close to closing out, if you don't mind. So the idea of my first sponsor putting my hand in God's hand, you know, just this, what today represents, it's happy hour here, is Good Friday, 3 o'clock. I don't know about you guys, but I would have been coming to and going on another run already. But I'm not, and I'm here, and I'm sober, and I'm grateful. You know, losing Peter's dad, losing my sister. You mean we all have things. You know, with a month ago, March 2nd, my brother had a massive heart attack and open heart surgery. My son had vision problems that thought he was going blind. And my niece had a brain aneurysm and was airlifted to Seattle and had brain surgery. I mean, this was all in 5 days. It's like, how do we do all that? We do it with the support of Alcoholics Anonymous. We do it with connecting to this power called God. We do this with the power of the 12 steps and prayer and all these tools that we're given that are what just absolutely just laid at our feet. Knowing that we're known by God, knowing that God carries me. I don't give this talk. I don't do any of this stuff. But I'll tell you, it's not about what I get. It's about what I give. And if you're new to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I welcome you. And I pray that you found something, have connected with someone, that something I've said or something somebody says this weekend really just helps touch your heart. Because, guy, this is for me, it's not about information. It's about the transformation that's happened in my life. That I'm not the woman that the woman I looked at in the mirror on November 11th, 1989, who was 30 years old with 3 kids, who is dead and broken, is still the woman I fight for today. That's the woman I owe to reach out. That's the woman I owe to do my inventory. That's the woman I owe every day is her. and that little girl who didn't get the freaking ruffle socks. That's still me. So I usually read this with the 12-step talk, but it's just, I love it. There's a, it's this little poem by Sam Shoemaker. He was one of AA's indispensables. Had it not been for his ministry to us in our early time, our fellowship would not have existed today. Guys, it took doctors, it took ministers, it took a whole bunch, kind of like what it takes today, right, to keep us together. And Sam Shoemaker wrote this poem, and it's a shorter version than that, but really my responsibility of what I carry, we carry in Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, I stand by the door. I stand by the door, I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It's the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use me going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outreached, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing any man can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. So I stand by the door. So thank you guys for having me. It's so great to be here.